Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together and welcome to the stage, the incomparable Bambi!
What you'll remember? Nothing. I hope.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to Dissect That Film. This episode is a little bit different than what we usually do. We're back doing an interview with some amazing indie filmmakers. So podcasts are still in my head right now. That's the first word that popped in, but wonderful indie filmmakers. As we talk about a wonderful upcoming film called Bampire, and we have its writer and one of its stars of we have Zoe Wasserman and Malachi Sequoia. Did I say it right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
It's good.
Welcome to the show. We are so excited to talk about your little movie that you got going on. So before we, you know, go deeper into it, why don't you guys kind of introduce yourselves and kind of talk about, like, you know, what this movie is all about?
Yeah. So for those who don't know, it is the new Bambi horror movie, if you will. And it is a 90s creature feature. So it's an era piece. And it also has full on creature transformations, lots of practical effects. But one of the things that kind of makes our movie very unique and also kind of harkens back to the Bambi connection is that we actually have 2D hand-drawn animation as a very large part of our film. So if anyone's ever seen, like, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, that's like a really good example of what we're trying to achieve. And so we have these live action performances by wonderful actors like Malachi interacting with these monsters, creatures, even just fuzzy little animals that are all done in 2D hand-drawn animation by Josh Stifter, who he actually did the movie Tusk, Kevin Smith's film, with A24.
I did read that and I was like, wow. This is crazy. And your director, who I just had his name pulled up too.
The man, Taylor Morden.
Taylor Morden, yes. He's also the director behind The Last Blockbuster, which I actually checked out last year. It was a Netflix special documentary about the last blockbuster in your guys' home state, right? In Oregon.
Yeah,
Bangor. Yeah. And really well made. I really enjoyed that. And so seeing his name and seeing that he was attached to this, that also gets me very excited. A lot of this, everything you just said, I'm getting all giddy because I am a sucker for these, like, taking these public domain characters and kind of bringing them to the horror scene. You know, we just, you know, are getting past the Winnie the Pooh Blood and Honey 2, which we've talked about on this show. I loved it. And I can't wait for the Pooniverse and their story. So seeing what you guys are doing with Bampire, it got me all excited. And seeing what I've been able to see of it is just like, I can't wait for October or whatever this is going to be for you. So
thank you. As artists, it's really special when you get to play with something that already exists, right? In, like, mm-hmm. the zeitgeist of your culture. You I know that everybody since my grandma has known about Bambi. And so just to take my stab at that, or to mold that into what, you know, I feel like it could be, as from the aspects I've brought to Bampire, has been a privilege, a very exciting thing to do. And, you know, it also can be a cliche. It can be done poorly as well. So I'm excited just to talk about the reasons behind it and what the execution of trying to take something and elevate it or showcase it in a new light that's useful and unique, instead of just taking something and trying to make money off of it because you know people already will relate.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I think for like our inspiration of taking this like Bambi character was really not from the children's cartoon that we know and love. It was actually from this original novella that was created as an allegory for World War II. World War I, my bad. But ultimately it's a really beautiful story about not this man versus nature story that is retold by Disney, but it's actually a story about how nature is a place where all things must fight to survive, including humans. And so that's like a really big part of the theme of Vampire is, yes, we've taken this quirky, crazy concept of having a shape-shifting vampire deer that can, you know, turn from a human into something that'll murder you in the woods. But we've actually like infused it with a lot of these deeper themes of like what it feels like to be a part of a culture that's really disconnected from nature and really separates itself from nature, and what it would feel like to be not quite so separate anymore, not quite so protected as we pretend like we are, and what it would feel like if it was reskinned as these like community college students in the 90s going out into their backyard and finding a lot more than they bargained for. So we did like take a lot from this, like with the animation, we took, you know, pieces from this new narrative. But personally, like, as much as I love a lot of the boon of rewriting these children's stories, the parts of Vampire that really spoke to me were actually the source material, you know, where it originally came from. And those are not children's stories most of the time. Even in our most popular cartoons that we watch, like The Little Mermaid, these stories are horrifying. They're originally horror stories, you know? So I just love that people are actually like almost making just this little cultural like correction. You know, it's like, it's almost like they're fighting just a little bit against this, you know, what we've made them. And they're kind of turning back into their creepier, more monstrous selves. And I just love being a part of that movement with Vampire.
Yeah, that's such a interesting idea. The fact of like, you have the original source material, which is not child friendly, you know, and then Disney, well, we're going to say Disney because Disney is the one who took all of these stories and made them for kids, even though they still sometimes weren't for kids, even with the Disney label on it. And now it's going back to its true form. And I think that's why I'm so intrigued with these, where you have a lot of people, especially if you look at like the Pooniverse, or that whole thing that's going on right now, where people are like, this is ruining my childhood. Like, this is you're destroying Winnie the Pooh. You're destroying Bambi. You're doing this and that. And I'm this type of person. I'm like, bring it on. I want this. I want the darker side because it's one of those things you could separate them. You know, I have young kids, so like I still love all those Disney movies and watching the original Winnie the Pooh or watching the original Bambi. I have it back there in like three different forms. I enjoy those movies, but I think, you know, giving us kind of a different interpretation, I think it's always great. And I think people need to accept it more, but sometimes you just can't make everybody happy. So I read, Zoe, that you grew up in Alaska.
Yeah.
And then you moved to Oregon, which is where you're currently at. So how much of that journey influenced this story?
Well, I will say that Alaska is a pretty harsh place to grow up. The environment is harsh. The weather is harsh. Even the people can be harsh because they're a product of their environment and the weather. So ultimately, like, it's a pretty intense place to live. And, you know, I think this idea of not being so separate from nature, you really get to see that in a place where you have no sun for like 6 months, because people become different. You realize, oh, these cycles that are affecting the plants and animals, blah, 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 around me, they're affecting the people in the video store and the post office too. That's odd. And so I think like the combination of, you know, having to acknowledge that this separation is kind of imposed, it's kind of inventive, it's kind of an illusion to make us feel safe. That combined with the fact that I couldn't go on a hike without people warning me about like 6 or 7 different dangers, you know, bears, crevasses, whatever else, you know, they could really think of in that moment. That was an issue that summer, bird-sized mosquitoes, you name it. really, like, I grew up in a place where the natural world wasn't so safe. It wasn't so much like a backyard. I lived in the middle of nowhere. and in a place where there are some of the largest natural predators that are still around. And it became, I think, a bit of like a, I wanted to go out. I wanted to experience the nature and the outdoors. And so I did, but I faced a lot in doing that. And I saw a lot of people not respect it and treat it in a way that they got, I mean, they got themselves hurt, just to say it simply. You know, they just didn't take it seriously, what you're really doing when you go out at the whim of nature. And I loved the idea that there could be a conscious version of that fearful spirit that is nature. Like, if there could be something that is as dangerous as the natural world, that's the vampire. And if there could be something that was standing up against those petty crimes that we commit against nature without even realizing we're doing it, what would that look like? How would it treat littering? Even though it seems small, when you really look at the impact on a larger level, how would it treat something that we completely see as almost a non-issue, but is one of the like biggest issues around? So it's not like harping on this with the plot of the movie. It's a campy, fun, young screenplay about a bunch of people who are a little bit directionless, all looking for a path in life. And they all go on this science field trip, you know, with their wacky professor. So it is like, you know, it's got a lot of lightheartedness to it, but there is a real depth to like where I was coming from when I created this cryptid with Malachi, bringing his own set of knowledge of growing up, like literally in the middle of the woods for most of his young adult life. Like we've been like pretty tight with nature, and we've seen a lot of people kind of mess with it and get hurt in doing so. And so this like conscious nature incarnate that became the vampire is really a combination of a lot of those things, you know, probably a big product of my upbringing, but definitely a Malachi's too. And just of things I've even experienced as an adult in Oregon, watching people just not take it so seriously when in reality, like, don't fuck with nature, bro.
it's so crazy. Cause if you think about the monsters of literature or even film, a lot of it is based around what humans have done to the planet, or, you know, what, and work for, you know, they're just kind of terraforming their own version of that in a monster form. And I've always found that so fascinating, because I don't think people look really that deep into it. They're just like, oh, that's a cool monster. Like, that's a cool, you know, that's something cool that's going to kill a lot of people, or, you know, do whatever it does. But I think looking deeper into certain monsters, you know, if you think of like, you know, the alien from The Thing and what that represents, or, you know, even, you know, Frankenstein's monster, one of the oldest, you know, monsters in literature, you know, what do they mean? Well, they mean something a lot deeper. You just got to look into it. And I like that that's how you were able to kind of form your story. So Malachi, where do you come into this? Like, how did you get involved in all this?
So I'm the guy who realized that musk deer are like a real animal. They're a deer with fangs, 100% real. I'm that guy. And I came to Zoe with like, hey, what if these bitches were actually vampires though? And the rest is history, honestly. That's so awesome. I'm like a co-creator of the universe, and we tackle things like developing the lore around our cryptid together. But yeah, that's how it all got kicked off. And then I wrote like a very, very partial outline for Vampire, and then handed it off to Zoe, and she's done, you know, all of the work that made it what it is today. But then I got to act in the film as well, and I'm a producer of it. So. Yeah, I've been very much on the sidelines, kind of pushing the idea forward and trying to be helpful at any step of the way that I can.
And he has been, for the record.
I mean, I see you guys doing all these interviews, so it's cool to see you guys kind of working together and getting to share, you know, this. I mean, as I said, I'm excited for what's to come with this. From what I've seen, a little bit.
Malachi is actually one of the first people I met when I joined like my local filmmaking community. So for all those like independent folks out there, just know that like there are other people out there that probably share your dream. Maybe even if you're lucky in your local community, but reaching out to them really brought my dream into fruition. And it's been really wonderful to have him as a business partner. So Wouldn't, well, I was gonna say, do without you, buddy.
I was gonna chime in because Malachi actually answered my big question, because we were talking about this the other night. Parker's like, dude, remember we got an interview with these guys, it's about this, you know, the deer movie. I was like, all right, sweet, all, you know. And he's like, it's like tusked deer. I was like, yeah, those are real. Like, who aside from like me, because I was like, yeah, dude, tusked deer, you know what those are, right? I was like, what the hell are you talking about? You're full of it. Yeah. So that's why I'm glad somebody other than me knows this obscure animal. I kept thinking they were extinct. Obviously, no.
They're endangered, though. They live in like Russia and China. They're like smaller than other deer for the most part. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they hunt them for their gland, their musk gland, apparently. It's money. Sense. Always the money.
Yeah.
I know. It's a shame. I know. Save I'm just glad. I'm just glad the connection was brought, because I was like, okay, we're doing a vampire deer. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But like, it's fine. You know, whatever. I'd like monsters. But like, I like how you're trying to put like a real world basis to it.
Totally, totally. And so part of what happens in our script is they discover evidence. It's like some misinterpreted cave paintings of musk deer in the Pacific Northwest, which is not a real thing. They've never actually lived here. But that's kind of where we bring in the real animal to our script. And yeah, that's what the community college students are out there to explore and try to discover.
Hey, as somebody that has gone to look for specimens in the field, yes, I understand. Not for that, but for other stuff, yes.
It's about you! This movie's you! Well,
mine was for spiders, and that was an interesting... And we got lost in the woods in Mississippi, so that was an interesting experience.
That sounds like a horror movie!
It was when we saw a big... When we looked up in the tree and we saw just a large pair of green eyes. I don't know what it was. It's Mississippi, so there could have been jaguars or anything down there.
And I was jaguars?
Like, yeah, we get jaguars. They come up from South America. They actually live in southeastern United States. Okay. Yeah, right. Legit. Wow. But yeah, like I was like, I don't like this. I don't feel comfortable. This seems larger than a raccoon that I'm used to. Not my nonsense.
So Malachi, explain to us who your character is, as much as you can. It can provide information on.
Yeah.
And, what's your character all about?
So my character is sort of the bad boy of the group. He's not actually a college student. He's just selling drugs and not going to college. And he has like a crush that he doesn't want to admit on one of the girls. He's like trying to date her, although he's very much like not willing to be her boyfriend. He still tries to like get her to take him on this trip. And he brings a gun, like a handgun camping. He brings a handgun and a basketball. It's kind of like, there's only like one moment where you see that
he's that guy. All right. We talk about that guy a lot when we review movies. We talk about that guy. So yeah, I'm excited to see your interpretation of that guy.
It's good. And there's some real kind of depth and like humbling moments that he goes through during the screenplay that are really fun and also impactful, I think.
Which is great to hear, because I feel when you watch movies kind of that maybe in a similar vein, or that character is usually the one who is just nothing. He's just a dick. Like he's just a dick. And then you're just like, well, I hate that guy. And he has no redeeming factors, that he just disappears or he dies in glorious fashion. Body so count. I'm very excited to see you take that character and give him some depth, and I'm very excited when we actually, you know, when your movie fully comes out and we're 100% going to be doing an episode of it on the show. I can't wait to talk about your character.
I think you guys are doing it. There's a lot of depth, a lot of unexpected depth in Vampire that, you know, like you think maybe it's just this, you know, catchy horror film, but the characters really do go through they have a really grounded sense about them, and then they go through some real interesting growth during the story, not just mine.
Yeah, I think that's a big problem, I think, with a lot of people who just don't understand these, you know, micro budgeted or low budget indie films. Is like they just expect, especially when it comes to horror, I think there are a lot of indie horrors are just very much misinterpreted, because they expect it's just going to be about a killer killing people and there's going to be no development with characters. And so when you finally see that movie and you're like, guys, there's a lot of movies here. They have heart. They have like characters who grow from the beginning to the end. You know, you have characters that might die that you actually grew close to. And it's like, they're there. You just need to find them. Because mm-hmm. I think that's why a lot of people just kind of, you know, you gravitate more towards the bigger budget movies and stuff like that. And it's like, no, you got to give these ones more of a chance, because these are the ones where the people behind the cameras have more care for them. I'm not saying like big budgeted people don't care for the movies they make, but I feel you really feel the heart and soul that, you know, indie filmmakers like yourself are putting into your movies. And that's why we love to watch them. You know, even the schlockiest of indie horror or indie, just indie films, period. Even though you're like, ooh, there's a lot of problems, but there's always something to love about them. And that's why, you know, getting to talk to you guys, it's great. And it just gets me more excited for your movie. I'm going to keep saying it throughout this whole thing. I'm very excited to check this out. You have some pretty big names in your movie. You have Lloyd Kaufman, the man behind Troa, is in your movie. I'm like, I was like, oh, all right. Okay, Lloyd's okay. There, baby. You have Greg Sestero from The Room. And if you ever, next time you see Greg, can you just ask him what happened with Retro Puppet Master? I'm not going to say anything more. Just say, hey, what happened with Retro Puppet Master? And either he's going to be like, oh, I had a lot of fun with that movie, or it's the worst experience he ever had making a movie. Because that's a movie that I would love to talk to him about someday.
If it's the worst experience he's ever had, that is impressive.
Come no, on, was, he worked with Tommy really, Wiseau.
It was really, really cool to get to work with some of these folks. And really the coolest part of it was how supportive they were. A lot of them, you know, like Greg being just such a wonderful example of this, they came from a background in independent film. I mean, he's had mm-hmm. some of the craziest shit that could happen to a person on an independent film that happened to him. You know, so he was able to come on and say, hey, you know, I know that you feel it's only 12, 13 people. And how are 12, 13 people making an entire movie and moving all of these moving parts around and keeping it together, large in part? And he was like, you're really doing a lot better than you even realize. Like when they were on the set of Best Friends, he told me a story where he was one of four people making that film. And he was in the movie. Like, and he's one of the four crew as well. And it's like, that's where some of these folks started. And so when
he directed that one, didn't he?
What was that?
Did he direct that?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think that he had another one of his, not Tommy either, but one of his other friends was the director technically, but he was like a grip. He was doing all of like his own makeup. He was like wearing his wounds to bed at night just so that they could get up and film. You know, he can move all the lights and then just go right into filming the next morning after only getting like 3 hours of sleep. And it just really brings it into focus that like, yeah, we had no money. I mean, we had a budget from a movie in the 80s. I mean, we are working with that level of funding in, you know, in modern times. And it was an insane thing to try to make this film with the amount of money that we did have. But what we had in addition to a very small amount of money was a hell of a lot of human spirit. And every single person who showed up on our set, from the two of us, sure, and our other two producers, Taylor Morden and Emily Clare, who were just incredible. But every single one of the crew members, down to the last PA, some of whom had never been a PA on a film set before, gave 110%. They stepped up into any job we needed them to at a moment's notice and took it on like they were consummate professionals. And I've just never seen that level of love just gas a project the way that it did for Bam Prior, because they're really, by all rights, we should have not succeeded at what we just tried to do. I mean, making a 90s era creature feature with no money, practical transformation sequences, you know, live action performances with 2D hand-drawn animation interacting. All of those things sound impossible when I say them in a list. Every single one of them feel impossible to achieve. But somehow, just through careful adaptation, careful planning, and making sure that every single person who we brought onto that film set was there for the love of the artwork, and most importantly, above all else, the story, only because we had those things at our back were we actually able to succeed at finishing principal photography. And thank goodness, because it's really made our Indiegogo everything that it could be and more to have that footage and to show people, hey, this is a really good movie that just needs your help getting it that last little bit, you know, across the finish line to get it out there to people.
Absolutely. And your Indiegogo is full of fantastic perks. So you literally, you get a VHS of this movie. Everybody, whoever's listening, if you, this is a movie that is, as they stated, it's the 90s. So what better way to watch this movie, which is most likely what I'm going to do, is watch this movie on a VHS. It's like no better way. So seriously, go to Indiegogo and look up Vampire and look at all the amazing perks that are on their Indiegogo. Help them out. There's a lot of great stuff. You could be an EP. You could be an EP on this movie. All right. I mean, I will not be. I can't afford that, but you can. So do it. One of you out there. Dan, you got anything you want to ask?
I do. I have a very, I don't know if I can ask this because it was in the little teaser information we were shown.
Let's go.
Yeah.
And this is the hard hitting stuff that you know I'm going to ask about. Listen, there's a lot of reasons for a man to have his dick in a sock. But I want to know why this man is in the middle of the woods with his dick in a sock, seemingly away from everybody else.
Right.
You don't have to tell me, but that's just like in my mind. That's like the big question. Like, I want to know what's happening here.
It really is the big question, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's the one that eats away.
I think Branson's as you could assume, he's a bit of like a fuck boy, and so he's always kind of trying to throw that dick at anything that moves. and this is just a moment where it kind of gets turned back around on him, and like he's made a fool of and left out in the woods without any of his clothes. And it's funny, we put all these like fake bug bites on my ass and like all over my back and stuff. And they were like still on me for weeks afterwards.
Right, sterile moment there. Yeah, you're living the dream.
No one wants to help you take the bug bites off your ass. They'll put them on, but they don't want to help.
That's on you, dude. Yeah.
It's like we got near your ass the first.
So there's like quite a bit of nudity in the film in every type of way. We wanted to make it like a real classic example of a horror film. But we also wanted to play with the kind of cliche trope of always like of like female sexual exploitation of like some hot chick just always getting naked out there right before she gets killed. And so that does happen with females in the film too, but we really wanted to put the biggest spotlight on a male character and sexually exploit a male for once.
And he was very willing. He was super willing.
He just on set, just drops his pants. Like, dude, not yet.
Hold on.
when that's the first thing you see in the what we saw, I went, oh, wrap me in. Where are we going here? And it just goes for it. That whole like 3 minutes that we watched, it was like, all right. I'm sold. Let's go.
My wife and I were like, we need to watch the sizzle reel. And I was like, where do you want to do it? I was like, let's watch it downstairs because I don't know what the fuck's on this. And I'm glad I was just on my phone. I'm just like, the kids aren't around. I was like, all right, that's fair. I'm glad that we opted for this.
Put it on the family TV.
Yep. Honey, we got something to watch.
It's not for kids. Vampire is not for kids.
Gather around. Let's see what happens to this individual.
This young man has his cock in a sock.
Why is it there, Dad? Well, sometimes when you get older, you'll learn you make mistakes.
Yeah. Vampire is a 21st century teen horror comedy like we haven't seen in the movie theaters in decades.
Part live action, part cartoon. You gotta think Evil Dead 2 meets Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
It's a little scary. It might have a little bit too much gore for me.
It's got VHS, it's got practical effects, it's got hand-drawn animation by Josh Stifter, and we've got appearances by indie film icons like Diane Franklin from Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. We got Greg Sestero from The Room.
Oh, hi, Mark.
We even got Lloyd Kaufman, and if that doesn't spark your goat, I don't know what does.
X-Kong that just came out costs like $140 million to make, so it's like, guys, we can do it with like the minuscule budget that movie cost, like, we can do it. So like and like in the indie circuit, I mean, you're kind of doing the same thing. I mean,
yeah.
And you guys are doing a great job. I mean,
yeah, you could make a million vampires for how much they made one of those movies for.
Right.
You know, and that's
right,
true.
Exactly.
Yeah, you get your one and that's mm-hmm. great. Good for you. And ultimately, who can ignore the benefits of working with a major studio and the quality, mm-hmm. you know, that you
oh,
can
yeah.
achieve with some of these special effects? It's incredible. And like, they're just such obvious benefits to having that at your back. But in mm-hmm. reality, how many movies would we have if we had divvied out that $15 million right. to all those great screenplays out there that do exist? And for us, yeah. you know, that's our competition. Even though it may seem silly, we're a creature feature too. And we right. didn't go the route of CGI. We went the opposite direction, you know, and because we wanted to kind of harken back to these movies that we loved growing up, that we wanted yeah. to make our own version of, you know, of Who Framed Roger Rabbit or The Evil Dead 2. We wanted to get, you know, just try. Just to say, if we have the want and it's a movie we want to see and we're willing to do it, and yeah, we don't have a lot and we have barely enough to even make it work, let alone pay everybody what they're really worth, we still did it, you know? And really, that yeah. was, it was such an incredible feat to have that many people say, okay, if it means we get to make Vampire, yes. Whatever the question was, if it means we get to make Vampire, yes. And just to have so many people like jump on board and not to have that, like that profit motive, you know, of how are we going to make the most amount off of this in the end? Or how do I get my name as the biggest credit? It wasn't about that. It was about how do we make a piece of artwork that's actually going to stand out from the rest. And that's so hard to do at our budget level that I tend to use the word impossible. Because it is. That's the level of feat that we're attempting to accomplish right now. It's something that just almost never happens. And that we all knew going into it that it may fail. We knew that we had invested everything that we had, and we knew that it was a massive risk, and we knew that there was very little chance that it would succeed as fully as we needed it to. I mean, we had such a limited window of time to film this thing. We filmed the whole movie in 3 weeks. Because that's how long we could afford to have our lead ensemble in town. You know, that's the exact amount of days that we could afford to work our actors. And so that's how we scheduled our shoot, was exactly how much we had and getting done exactly the amount we needed every day. And that amount was sometimes 8 hours, but sometimes that amount was 16 hours worth of work. And every single person stayed with us until the bitter end of that project. So, you know, the fact that we got where we were, and that our competition is working with a million times what we have, it truly is like a David versus Goliath kind of scenario here. But I just feel like, what a testament, you know, what a testament to what people can actually accomplish without, even if they don't have the budget, even if it does seem impossible, it's not.
There's a real almost corporate, you know, waste level where when you get to the $100 million film, you are not yeah. very efficient anymore with how you're spending those $100 million. And some of that's probably inevitable just from the outcomes of upscaling and outsourcing jobs and stuff like that. But the efficiency level that you can do if you put together a small team and every single dollar you put towards that film is used in the most efficient way possible, right? Like, no one's getting, you know, just for a million reasons, like every dollar is impacting the movie at such a large ratio. The thing is, though, with indie film, usually there's not enough dollars at all. Even if you could be really efficient, you still don't have enough to efficiently make the movie. And also, any of the super high talent level people are probably getting paid to work on big films. So we're playing in this weird middle ground where it's like no money and no talent. Well, that's amateur. And then there's this middle area where you have some money and some varying level of talent. And that's where we're at. And it's right before everybody is about to move on to being like a specialized professional in the industry. And so it's so much about finding the people who are right there, who have put the work in, who have built the skill set for themselves and are primed to take off in a huge career, but they're just one project short and they just need one really high quality thing to be added to their portfolio, and then they've broken through. And part of our goal is to build a company that exists at that level and empowers the art and also the artists just that exist at that middle ground. Like, that's probably where the majority of actors and of screenwriters are out right now. Yeah. They've been doing it for a few years. They've got some real talent. Nobody gives a fuck yet, though. Nobody knows their name. And people like us who maybe can care so much about the art that we see that screenplay or we see that audition and we know it's going to be good just because of our relationship to the genre and the art form. We don't need any sort of proof beyond that. So we can be bold and make that bet on that person and also get a really, really, really good deal on them, right? Because they're as talented as someone who would cost 10 times more. They're just one job short of breaking through. So yeah, we've been playing with all of that, and that's where Bampire exists in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, it's yours. You know, you're in control of everything. So it's, you know, every decision that is made, it is your decision. So you don't have any oversight from somebody else telling you, I think you should give her, you know, you should add this. You know, it's what we're going to see is your idea, you know, what you did. And I think that, you know, I think means a lot. I think, I mean, from other indie filmmakers that I have talked to, it, that's kind of like the biggest thing for them. It's like, yeah, it's difficult, you know, you know, pretty much penny pushing, kind of figuring out where to put that mm-hmm. penny for that next mm-hmm. thing. But it's like, but all yeah. I know is that at the end of the day, it's mine and everything that is happening is my, you know, and, you know, it's crazy to hear, you know, as somebody who has literally done nothing, I just talk about movies, getting to talk to people who make them and really appreciate the craft and really are passionate about what they're doing and the way that they're doing it and just how hard it is. And I think that's something I think people are really scared of talking about. It's like, you can, like, movies are hard to make. I mean, coming from you guys can yeah. attest to that. You guys are doing mm-hmm. it. But I think people also need to realize it's just because they're hard to make, you can still, you know, talk about them in whatever way you feel. And mm-hmm. I think that's the biggest misconception is the fact it's like, oh, you can't say bad things about a movie. Movies are hard.
Yeah.
Okay. I get that, but I mean, I don't know what do you guys think of that kind of statement?
That, bro. Fuck that. If art's bad, critics, art's
yeah.
bad.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe it can be good for someone else. I'm humble yeah. enough to admit that I might mm-hmm. hate that piece of art, but it might bring value into someone else's life.
Right.
Yeah. But I'm gonna say what I think. You know, I'm definitely. I think that having enough love and respect in the way you say it is the only thing that matters. Yeah. But what you're saying, you should be able to speak your full opinion.
Yeah, and you should be able to be told that you're wrong. You know, it's one of those moments where it's like, if you never put it out there, you never get it corrected. And you isolate, you find yourself in communities that all agree with you. I mean, we see it in so many different facets of life that's how it works when you stop actually sharing your real opinion on something. And it creates a confirmation bias in your close circles, in your socials, whatever. You don't want to be out there just getting patted on the back because you've said what everyone else has said. And mm-hmm. when it comes to art critiques, I mean, as someone who has put, you know, their screenplay out there and will, I mean, you don't even know. I mean, like the amount that we're going to get lashback for being just like the next new Bambi horror movie, like there's going to be the same amount of, you do know, you even talked about it, that there's going to be 50% of people who are going to hate it just because we did it. But that's why we did it. Yeah. You know, yeah, like that's a big part of the, you know, that's a big part yeah. of what makes us something to talk about. And ultimately at our level, we have to play every fucking chip that we have in our favor because we have the smallest handful. But if we can play at the table, you know, with the big dogs, then who knows? Maybe we clean up. It's like, it's one of those moments where, like, if you're smart with your bets and you believe in what you're doing, like, we didn't choose this project to double down on and put our whole life savings into just because it was like a fun, wacky thing to do. Like, that is part of it. We're fun and wacky, but we did 6 months of pre-production work and tried to find a budget for this thing. We tried to find investors. We put our, I mean, our director searched high and low. We made every ask that we could, but none of us could come up with a budget for this thing that was anywhere besides our own freaking pockets. So in the end, it really came down to, well, do we believe in it? Do we think that this thing could be great? And in the end, what I told myself as one of the primary investors in the movie, if I don't believe in it, then who else will? How do I convince someone else to take a risk on me that I'm not willing to make? And I was like, fuck that. That's not who I am. Like, if I really want to make this thing and I really think that it's profitable and I'm telling it, you know, anyone I'm related to, anyone I just met on the street, hey, if you want to be a film producer, we've got this amazing project. If I believe those words coming out of my mouth and I have the ability to make it happen, then why am I not making it happen? And that's like, there's a level of belief in your artwork that you have to have in order to put it out there to begin with, but especially because it's going to be met with an onslaught of opinions that say it's not good, or it's, they might not even watch it and they might think it's not good. But if we didn't put it out there, you know, if we didn't accept that there would be criticism, then we wouldn't have what we do now. And honestly, like, it's a privilege to have the world judge your artwork. It is a privilege to have people respond to your artwork and react to your artwork. And the only issue that I see with that as an artist, you know, as someone who might be receiving that criticism, is that for those artists, they just can't take it personally and they need to treat themselves like they are the authority of their own piece. And even if there are things that people don't relate with, if they don't see it, if they don't get it, doesn't mean they have the answer on how to fix it either. You got to look inward for that stuff and you got to listen when people give you feedback, but it doesn't mean that they're giving you the answer. They're pointing out a problem and it's your job to fix it. So, you know, there's a level that you kind of have to be willing to have that communication with the universe. Otherwise, you're just throwing something out there, you know, and you're not, and you don't really care how it sticks. And that's not the kind of attitude that you need to have if you want to make something that people are really going to respond to and have a relationship with in the end. You got to come at it as a bit more human, a bit more emotional, and with care for that piece, that you're willing to defend it and that you know why you made the decisions that you did, even if someone else doesn't agree with them.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's one of those things for me where, you know, if you see something, like, for instance, if someone were to see the poster for your movie and you have the tagline, "Not your mother's Bambi," which I think is a tagline that I think people would like, that 100% somebody was going to read and be like, not for me, not gonna, yeah. not,
like, I'm not. And
right. And it's one of those things where it's like, okay, then just move on. Exactly. It's the people who will see that and go, I don't want to see that. And then they'll go on the internet and just completely bash your movie that they have not seen because of a title and a tagline. And that's what pisses me off. It's like, yeah. I have watched some pretty atrocious movies in my life, but I will always give them a chance. And I will always find some shining light, even in the pile of garbage, that I can point out and be like, at least they did this. And that is no way aimed at what your movie is going to be, because I doubt that it's even going to be close to what I just described.
I'd love for you to try to find something in there, bro. Like,
No. I'm talking about the fact that it's not going to be a pile of garbage. It's going to be,
You're an artist, bro. That makes you an artist. The ability to see that and choose what to value within it instead of just seeing, you know, all of it and assuming it dictates that for itself. It's not. If you love one single part of something deep down to your core, that can affect you and teach you so much. And just being willing to empower yourself to even have those, you know, viewpoints on art, that is in and of itself art that you're doing 100%.
I've grown a lot in the 3 years of doing this podcast. You know, in the beginning I was a lot meaner to movies, and I've kind of grown. I've grown to respect and be able to find the bright spots in some muddy movies. You can ask Dan.
That is so beautiful, though, and that's growth. And I mean, any haters, catch me outside, bro. I'm not gonna just take your shit. But yeah. At the same time, if you're willing to even watch my movie, I feel thankful to you. And if you have an opinion on it, I feel just beyond blessed that you're willing to share that opinion with me. Even if it's, hey, that was shit, it wasn't for me, I will genuinely take that. And I'll be like, the next movie I make, one guy hated the last one. You know, how much does that mean to me? Probably not that much, but it's the interaction there where you get the truth out of someone and they're willing to witness your truth is so beautiful and so invaluable. But then as an indie filmmaker, I'm around all sorts of little projects that may or may not be good. And I always say they're good, you know, like there's a level too, where you just can't be an asshole.
People who are trying. They're not dream killers. Like,
when you're just coming out right off the rep, you're like, that was trash. You know, you're like, oh, let's gradually get into where the hell you're going. Okay. Dan, you got anything else you want to ask?
Yeah, I actually do have one more. And this is for me. And if y'all don't want to answer, that's totally fine. Nor if you know, if you can't speak on it. On your, I'm a firearm enthusiast of sorts. And I noticed a movie used a sub. Did you use actuals? Did you use replicas? I know there seemed like a few shots of some mm-hmm. weapons in your trailer. But
a combination. Yeah, we actually had an airsoft gun. So, go ahead.
We have two real firearms. One is like a rifle that I think we took the pin out for when it was on set. Mm-hmm. Some sort of shotgun too that Greg Sestero wields. But then my character brings like a Glock, and it's mm-hmm. a replica airsoft Glock that has like a kickback when you do shoot. Like it
simulates the reciprocating the mass on top, the slot. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what we had for any of the onset, for that gun, and that's the only one that actually gets. No, the rifle gets fired too. Yeah, but so there's at least one point where the handgun gets fired and it does its little kickback thing.
Yeah, and like
we've
been, you know, there's been a lot of just turmoil in the industry around the use of real guns on set with the incident on Rust. Obviously, that was incredibly sad. The fact that we lost a young Ukrainian cinematographer who was just the beginning of her career is just, it's heartbreaking. It's impossible, you know, to imagine it being on a set where you were in charge of something like that happening.
Yep.
And ultimately, that was a massive concern for us because we have a child who wields that airsoft gun. And the airsoft gun itself looks like a real gun. And so at one point, we were filming outside a strip club. And we were just in the parking lot, right? But this gun is in like a paper bag in the scene. And I went to hand it off, you know, to the actor who was going to be utilizing it. And he doesn't take the gun out of the bag at all in the scene. But when I handed it to him, it kind of struck me like, hey, man, don't take this gun out of this bag because this looks like a real gun. So if someone drives by and they see you with this thing in your hand, like it feels like a real gun. It's metal. If they take it out of your hand, it still feels like a real gun. Like, and it kind of hit me like even just holding a gun that looks real, even if it's like an airsoft gun, it's not even a gun that could kill someone if it was fully put together and working, mm-hmm. That is dangerous. And it's just really something to maintain a very high level of awareness around, even if your guns are completely fake or dismantled, that even holding a gun in a threatening way or in a public space, that can get you in just as much trouble as anything else.
Yep, because it's however, like you said, it's however it perceives you from the outside. And I just noticed watching the trailer, I picked up on little things. It's just something that movies do every once in a while. It's like trigger discipline stuff, which I don't try to throw people under the bus for, because not everybody knows. But you're right, because like when people see stuff, they just see it. And like there's been many robberies and instances, people just use fake guns because they're convincing enough and that works. And if you don't know, you're not going to question it. So, and it wasn't to bring up any negative light or anything. I think I was just curious because I love them, and I've known about the Rust, the unfortunate side of that, but. Yeah. I didn't know how it works on like how it was like on your film set or like, cause I don't know. Yeah. I don't do that kind of work. So that's why I was just curious.
It's cool to talk about it. It's really relevant right now. And people should have that level of awareness about it. You know, it isn't talked about clearly, like to have something that happen at that height of the industry. It's
And on indie film, like, you're looking for props anywhere you can get them. You're like, hey, do you know anyone with a gun? We're out of money. That's literally what it came down to.
Yeah, that's what I understand. Given the budget y'all had, like there's certain things like, and I don't even know where was this film filmed? Like where did you film the movie?
In Eugene, Oregon. So we actually filmed like just in our local community.
Okay, which makes sense. And you know, states vary. Like, I don't care to tell people I'm from Tennessee. You know, I'm from the South. Like, it's a really common thing here. But I've never been to Oregon. I don't know how folks are with that kind of stuff. I mean, I imagine it's a more forested area up in Oregon, so there's probably some degree of hunting that people do. You know, it's always like I like to ask how it's different. So
yeah,
it's a little more political here, but there are definitely like there is definitely a lot of it still, though. Like growing up in Alaska, it's like there's legitimately more guns than people in one guy's basement. You know what I mean? Yep. It's like that's like the culture that I grew up in with guns was it was flooded, you know. But in reality, like that gave me, you know, maybe a little bit of that extra awareness in that moment and that I needed to keep people safe on this set. So I'm still grateful for it being a part of my culture personally.
Which is good, because that's, again, the thing that I think that's a lack of exposure to some people. Like, I didn't grow up with it. My grandfather was big into my mom's dad or whatever, but he was big into it. And my parents weren't, but I grew up to be one, but my kids know about it. But I teach them very safe rulings with them and so on and so forth, because I think that's the thing, is people are around, they don't know how to interact with them, and that's when accidents happen. But anyway, I'm not here for that. Sorry. I'm getting way too into that.
It's important.
It's good. Sorry. Yeah. We love it. Yeah, we want to talk about it.
I still remember like the first time my grandpa took me out shooting, I was like pulling up to aim and I accidentally pulled the trigger before. And it's like little moments like that stick with you, and they should, because that's a real danger you're around. And the worst thing you can do is be unaware of a danger that is in your life.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So let's talk. I want to ask a question that has been in my head since I've been thinking about after I watched the clip that you guys sent. Because your movie is based partially on the original Bambi, what would be a character from literature or even a character from animation that you would like to tackle in like the same vein as Vampire?
That's a good question. Like, I would have to say, like, I really love making original stories. So as much as I've like drawn so much inspiration, you know, from that source material, what really like I love about the screenplay are the elements that we created, you know. And I think for myself, like a lot of the other screenplays that I've written, they're not based on source material. They're original ideas. And this just so happens to be one that had that, you know, congruency, if you will, with like this original story that really just like harkened back to the story that we had come up with of this like wacky cryptid. So, you know, we had kind of this relationship introduced to us where our movie, like originally our movie was called Deer Pyre. And so when we found out like, hey, this has a lot of similarities. And if we really like go back and look at this source material, like we actually are working with a lot of the same themes that this writer was trying to get across. Like, this is a cultural reference. This is a moment that we could actually bring a lot more attention to our piece if we kind of like acknowledge that it has this relationship to this really iconic character that everybody would recognize. And so it became Vampire. And that was like a really wonderful moment. You know, I really appreciate that we have that kind of pulling for us while we're trying to get this publicity, because it is like a big part of our story now that it has that relationship with it being kind of this allegory for nature just being such a difficult place to survive for any living creature. So for myself, like, I really love this connection that this one piece has, but I don't know if there's like, I don't know if I would want to retell a story that's already been told. That being said, if I had to, if you're twisting my arm behind my back, then I've always really loved and hated, because it's disgusting, the original Little Mermaid lore. And it's just a horrifying, horrifying tale in reality. As are most of these original stories. Like, even though we've turned them into like children's movies, in reality, they started as really as horror stories. And so, you know, I think that kind of pulls at me. Like, what would it look like if those stories were actually given like a shout out, I guess, but more to their like their origins, you know, instead of like trying to recreate what's already been done in a scary way, but really just going back to that original piece, like some of the Grimm Brothers stories and stuff like that. I think I could get really on board with that.
I think you could make a really sweet film that's pretty much, just Aladdin, but it's like a real gritty street kid version of Aladdin, where you really spend some time with how much his life sucks. You really spend some time with the type of skill sets he's had to develop to survive on the streets of this town where he's homeless and it's oppressing him. And then you kind of put the genie as like a alternate ego of himself, right? It's not as magical. And then you put him like rising up to then eventually marry the princess as this like very thought out, meticulous plan he's enacted to better his own life. And then you end it more so with like, well, he's still not happy now, or maybe he's actually the bad guy you realize at the end because he's an asshole and he wasn't actually doing this for any of the right reasons, even though it was so relatable and even though he needed to find some way out of that life for himself, right? Like, I think playing with trying to just get into the depths of what's grounded and interesting about a character like Aladdin might be actually a lot of fun for me.
That's interesting. Make like the genie kind of like half the genie and half Jafar. Like the way you kind of blend the two characters together. So yeah. he's like, you know, manipulates Aladdin at first, and then as you go further into the story, he becomes more evil and turns. Oh yeah, I like that. I like that.
Yeah, I like that.
What about you, Dan?
I had a dip. No, I was listening to the Little Mermaid moment, and I'm listening to this, and I had a different like line in my head. Do you guys know the movie Humanoids of the Deep?
Oh shit. Yeah, I think it's like in the the 60s, right? Like, or
it was late 70s, early 80s. They filmed that controversial rape scene where the fish dude comes out and rapes the woman. So this is gonna be weird. I've never seen the movie. I've heard of it. I was thinking of that, but the opposite, where it's the Little Mermaid, but they're just fish women that are up to like just boing dudes and like pull them to the depths. It would like roll reverse it. That's where I was. Yeah. I'm sorry. Like, in my mind.
Okay, I love this. We're co-writing now.
Well, the crazy thing was, you have the ideas. they kind of did that in the fourth Pirates of the Caribbean. They turned the mermaids into these evil, like, they're like, you know, these beautiful sirens, and then they would pull the men down and drown them.
Yeah.
Which does happen, but I was just thinking of more of the maybe the 70s, 80s, like exploitation angle.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
This is where my mind goes.
The aesthetic, too.
So, like, I know y'all aren't familiar with our show. Like, Parker's the straight man, and I'm just like, whatever's off the top of my head.
I would watch
that. Some underwater fucking whatever that is.
I love this like playing with this idea of this like sea witch cursing, you know, these beings to now be like literally disabled in a sense, like no voice or no whatever else, but like invading the shores of wherever they've come out of the water. It's like, it's a very weird amount of chaos that could really ensue if it was like the Little Mermaid en masse.
Yeah, there you go. Right.
Yeah, for me, it's I've always wanted Peter Pan. Peter Pan was always the perfect one because this dude literally kidnaps children and brings them to this Neverland. But we're getting it. We're getting it. So I feel like my idea was taken out of my head by another filmmaker and made into a movie. So
yeah, it's a real damn you,
Pooniverse. Yeah, very much, very much. I mean, I know it's a stupid question, but I have to ask it because, you know, vampire, it's this, as you stated, it's like a shape shifting vampire deer that, you know, hunts. And we have Bambi the Reckoning coming out this year as well, which is the Pooniverse version of Bambi, which is more of the classical Disney version that they're turning into a horror movie. Who do you think? Have you guys seen the teaser trailer for that movie?
No, we haven't.
I haven't.
Yeah.
I haven't actually, I haven't even watched Blood and Honey. Zoe has, but ours is going to be better and our cryptid would win.
There it is! I didn't even need to ask the question, everybody. I told you it was a lame question, but Malachi answered it without me even having to ask. All right. Well, that's...
Well, yours is going to be practical, so I'm sure you'll win anyway.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah,
practical effects will sell me every time.
It was a real, like, it was a real feat to develop, like, not only the creature version that we could accomplish in, like, a live-action version of the monster, but now we're playing with the animated version of our monster, too, which can be just that much more agile, just that much more, you know, crazy in terms of its like kill sequences and stuff. Like we've really been able to like explore a lot with using this extra element of being able to kind of, you know, cartoonize as needed. But we do have like a fully practical version of our vampire. So
there's a shot where it gets shot in the head and it's done all practical. And we only got one take at it, but it turned out we have these like brains shooting out effect and it's like facial skin flap ripping off effect, like all at the same time with people like yanking on strings and stuff like that.
It's crazy.
It turned out so well. I can't wait. It
sounds so sweet.
It was so fun.
was there anyone on set doing like behind the scenes footage, like filming behind the scenes stuff?
We have like some awesome Polaroids, we've got some great photos, but in reality, like that night, you know, for example, our finale, right, all hands on deck, it's like everyone is working at 4 to 5 times the pace that we really even should be trying to work, because it's like we're trying to shoot this in the middle of the night, you know, and it's raining and whoever's not working is holding an umbrella, you know. So in the end, we just didn't have enough bodies to really have like behind the scenes photography or videography going on besides what's just captured on either end of the take, you know.
Dan looks like
I figured it out. So the Little Mermaid thing was not my answer. I was just bouncing. I was always thinking, I figured it out. I was sitting here thinking like, what would I pick? And it's a cop out, and I don't have like a solid idea for it, but it's one of my favorite kids' books to read my children. Is I would love like a horror or like a suspense thriller version of Green Eggs and Ham.
Okay, go.
That's Sam I Am. That Sam I Am. I love reading that. I read it to my kids. So bad.
Yeah. Oh my God. That is a good one.
All right, Dan.
So I don't mean to jump back, but I literally do. I don't know how I kind of forgot this, but I literally have a screenplay that is in development. That is a version of, it's based off of Paul Bunyan. So that would probably be my answer. And it's like, imagine like The Shining meets Home Alone. And that's all I'll give you. But that's like, that's the idea. The Shining, the axe murderer, meets the clever creative kid that he just can't catch. And it's, so keep your eye on Path Films, because who knows what's coming out. Who knows?
Yes. Yeah, follow Path Films on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Follow Vampire on Instagram. Go to the Indiegogo, as I said, and look up Vampire. There's so many amazing perks there. You can literally get stickers, t-shirts, VHS, DVD, or Blu-rays. You guys doing DVDs too? Or are you just doing the Blu-rays and VHS? Blu-rays.
Is it okay? Do people like DVDs?
Yeah, if you like DVDs, tell us.
I don't know. I mean, I'm going for that VHS, all right? I'm going for that VHS. That thing is sweet.
I just want a hat.
Paula, thank you.
Yes,
I want either yours or the hat on the wall back there. Mm-hmm. I always wear hats.
Yes, get
it looks sick.
I wish I could just throw it through the screen.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're a little bit over an hour on this, so I feel this is a perfect place to end this. So as we do at the end of every show, you guys have the floor and pretty much share where everyone can find you and where, you know, where you want people to go.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. Go to www.vampiremovie.com. Probably forever. That'll be our website. Right now it's just going to redirect you to Indiegogo. So that's how you'll be able to find us quickly there. Vampire on Facebook, Vampire Movie on Instagram. We have a Path Films Instagram. It's very bare. We just made it, but that's where we'll go after Vampire. So if you're interested in following us there, also our co-producers, Pop Motion Pictures, they have a Instagram too. My name is Malachi. You can catch me on there too. And thank y'all. Vampire is going to be really awesome. So check it out.
Yeah, check out our website. We've got a lot of awesome stuff on there. It's all limited edition. It's the only way that you will definitely, absolutely, 100,000% get to see Vampire this year is if you go on to www.vampiremovie.com and make a donation, or get yourself one of our three copies, either digital, Blu-ray, or VHS, whatever works best for you. But that's the one way that you will definitely be able to see Vampire this year if you can't make it to the premiere in Eugene, Oregon.
Oh, please go. I'm going to be contributing to this wonderful movie because I am very, very excited and I want to see it this year. So yeah, please support this movie. This is it's been an absolute pleasure getting to talk to you two and get to hear just the passion that you guys have for what you're doing. And I think that's what I love about talking to, you know, filmmakers like yourself. It's just you can feel that it's really, you guys really love what you're doing. And you know, that's kind of what we try to do here. We love what we're doing here. So
thank you guys so much for having us. And you're in the Vampire family now. So yeah, we'll be here for you just as much as you're here for us. We'd love to come back on and talk about the movie and just like, congratulations, you guys. You've got a great show.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So yeah, every link that they mentioned will be down in the description of the video or in our show notes. So you can go there, click on the links, seriously, go to the Indiegogo, follow them on Instagram. They're very active over there. So, and they're, you know, they're two wonderful people and there's more wonderful people involved in the movie. So, thank you again, Zoe, Malachi. It's been a blast getting to talk to you. And yeah, I'm looking forward to this movie coming out and looking forward to talking to you guys again on more Vampire and beyond, whatever you guys are going to be doing next. So, Dan, do you have any final closing statements you'd like to make before we get out of here?
Clean your socks after you depart your cocks.
Your socks before when they depart your cocks. All right. That's a good way to end this, guys. All right, everybody. Until next time, I am Brett Parker. That is Dan. I almost said Dan and Angela, but D'Angelo ain't here tonight. And that is Zoe and Malachi of Vampire. And this has been another Dissect That Films interview. We'll see you all again next time. Have a great day. Bye.
Bye.